Good morning, folks. Can I add my welcome to that of Johnny? And can I also add my welcome to those people that maybe listen to this recorded? I know there's a lot of folks in the church can't be here due to health and so on. So I just hope that you too will be blessed as we look at Acts 9 together. So if you were listening when Joy was speaking to the children, she gave a really good summary of where we got to last week as we went through Acts. We met Saul the Pharisee on his way to Damascus to arrest any followers of what was called the Way. But we saw how in one encounter, the power and the presence of the now risen Jesus arrested Saul. It drove him down to his knees and he acknowledged Jesus was Lord. So in that meeting, rather than judgment, Saul received grace, love, and he received a commissioning of the highest order. And in that moment, the biggest enemy of the church at that time was neutralized. And he would become Paul, Jesus' messengers, not just to the Jews, but also to the Gentiles. And in a dramatic twist and turn of events, the persecutor becomes the persecuted. And Saul must now flee to his hometown in Turkey as his previous allies turn against him. And last week closed with verse 31 of chapter 9, which describes that with Saul converted and with their enemies preoccupied, the church throughout Judea, Galilee, and Samaria enjoyed a time of peace and encouraged, it was strengthened and encouraged by the Holy Spirit. It grew in numbers, living in the fear of the Lord. And so it would be great if you have a Bible in front of you. I'm going to work through the verses that Johnny read, and we're going to sort of dip in and out as we work through those. I'll not read them all, so it'll be helpful if you're able to go back and forth with me. So this morning, there's two stories contained in these verses of chapter 9. The healing of a paralyzed man and the resurrection of a lady who died. Both of them take place among Jewish background believers. And this is a time, as the verse said, of relative peace and stability for the church. These are actually some of the last recorded stories of the church contained in Jerusalem, Samaria, and Galilee. It's about to spill over and expand into the Gentile world. So if you come with me to verse 32, right away, the Apostle Peter is mentioned. Now, if you remember back a few weeks, the last time we heard of Peter, he was in Jerusalem, and he'd stayed there during the intense heat and pressure of persecution. I think that boldness that made Peter such an impulsive and outspoken disciple, if you know your Gospels, it now helped him bravely obey his Lord in remaining as a rock for the many Christians going through trial and painful circumstances. But this peace has had an effect, because Peter's now freed from crisis management, in a sense, so that he can now go beyond Jerusalem. The gospel has been trickling and has been expanding out. Peter can now go, and his desire seems to be to care for the many Christ followers that were springing up. So verse 12 says he went to visit the saints in Lydda. Verse 32. Now I'm not sure how long the last few chapters took to happen, but sufficient time had passed for Christians to draw together at Lydda and at Joppa. And I sort of flicked back through my Bible, and I think there's two ways, or maybe a combination of ways, this could happen. First of all, as always happens in persecution, some Christians flee. And they may have fled from Jerusalem into these surrounding towns where the pressure mightn't have been as intense. These are less than 30 miles away. And you can just see over in the bottom corner of the map, in the red box, there's Jerusalem and then Joppa and Lydda. But if you go back to Acts chapter 8, you'll see that God previously directed Philip the evangelist to encounter an Ethiopian eunuch. And then God transported Philip all the way to Azotus. And when Philip got there, he just preached his way up the coast from town to town. And I think this is how there came to be Christians along these towns. Actually, to be accurate, Luke, the author here, doesn't say Christians. He doesn't say believers or followers of the way. He uses that word saints. And that's a word that, as you and I read it today, can seem quite quaint. It can describe somebody who is who never really does anything wrong or who's exceptionally patient. I don't know how my wife puts up with me leaving power tools all over the kitchen table. What a saint she is, you might say. For others, you might have that idea of a notable godly person who is perhaps long dead, St. Patrick, St. Columba, who lived at Bangor Abbey. And both examples to us in 2017 probably seem fairly trivial. However, this biblical word that Luke uses, it has a much more definite meaning. The word is hagios. It's sacred, means sacred, physically pure or morally blameless, religiously or ceremonially consecrated. It's got an idea of something being otherly, unlike, holy. And given that meaning or that scope of meanings, when the Bible uses that word about people, it's suddenly quite a big thing. It's no longer quite quaint. I mean, if somebody was called a saint, surely they'd need to be cut off a wee bit separate, a wee bit otherly from everyday life and everyday temptations that we all face. But that's not what the Bible does here. In Acts 9, it's used in verse 13 and verse 32 to describe just ordinary people like you and like me who are Christians. We're saints, they are saints because they're holy or set apart, because God makes us holy from the inside out through that new birth, that new life that comes in Jesus. So in the Old Testament, you had items, cups, bowls, things that were used in temple worship that were ceremonially cleansed or cleaned, and then they were kept pure and uncontaminated. So God wants his people, his holy ones, his saints, to be set apart and kept pure for his use. So then, holiness, when we're talking about people and not objects, seems to be how God views us, so what we are in God's eyes, and then a sense of what we must then be, which is our response. How do we act? How does our character come out when we're pushed, tempted, stressed, joyful, happy, whatever the range of emotions and events of your life? Now, that can seem a bit academic and a bit dry. So as we go through this passage, I'm going to suggest you take a look at Tabitha. She's the lady that was raised from the dead here. Because I think in Tabitha's life, as it's presented to us, she's an example of someone who is a saint in the biblical sense of the word. She's a woman that God sees as a saint because of her faith in Jesus. But the new spiritual life that she now has means she is free. And she's free to be engaged in living out the life and example of the Lord Jesus among just others in her local community. She probably didn't get very far beyond Lydda or beyond Joppa. But she's fully engaged where she lives. She's not cut off, superior or distant. Her sleeves are rolled up and she's present. But we'll get to her in a while. We're going to come back into verse 33 and first take a look at the healing of Aeneas. So Peter visits Lydda and meets the saints there. It seems that this man Aeneas may be one of these believers. He's paralyzed. In fact, Luke, the doctor, is careful to say that he's been bedridden for 8 years. So it mightn't have been a paralysis from childbirth. It might have been something that happened to him. And if you look through your New Testament, you'll actually see there are loads of people that are paralyzed. If you have a King James, it'll say that he had the palsy. But what it's really describing is that loss of muscle power or damage caused by damage to the motor centers of the brain or the spinal cord. And even today, medically, much of this type of damage is completely irreversible. And back then, paralysis was far more commonplace due to injuries and poor medical treatment, due to things like strokes, due to even bacterial infections that we pop an antibiotic for, but that they didn't have the blessing of. So Luke shows us that this paralysis is probably permanent, perhaps even progressive, given he's been bedridden for 8 years. But think back, and if you're familiar with the Gospels, do you remember one of the first miracles that Jesus did was the healing of a paralyzed man? You know, this man was in such a bad way that his friends took him up to the roof of a packed out house where Jesus was teaching. They ripped apart the roof of the house. They lowered this man down in front of Jesus' feet for healing. And then if you remember, Jesus forgave the man's sins in a turn of events that made everybody sit up and watch. Healing was one thing. They were almost getting used to it. But forgiving sins, this is something different. And then, as they struggled with this, and many of them did, to show that Jesus had the power to meet spiritual needs, he almost casually healed a paralytic in front of them and asked him to take up his bed and walk. And he did. And Peter, the apostle in today's passage, was there back then. Well, Peter's now following an ascended Jesus. Jesus is in heaven with the right hand of God, but Peter's going to perform a similar miracle. So if you look at verse 34, you'll see that Peter commands, just like Jesus did, that Aeneas get up and tidy his mat. Perhaps Peter purposefully borrows that phrasing of Jesus to draw a parallel. But there's a difference. He doesn't claim to heal Aeneas himself. Instead, he states that Jesus Christ heals you. And just like the Jesus healing, this man's instantly healed and able to obey Peter. He gets up. It is an absolute medical miracle. There's no rehab. There's no physiotherapy. There's no crutches. There's no helpers. There's no program to take him from learning to use his muscles. This is supernatural, seemingly breaking all the rules of the known universe. Essentially, parts of Aeneas' body have been instantly restored in function. I wish I could have seen it. And the significance of this miracle has massive impact on people living in Lydda and Sharon. Remember, although they lived in the first century and were used to faith healers and soothsayers, they know that there's usually little real effect. They're in a world of medical as well as spiritual darkness. But they recognize that this healing is miraculous. And Luke's also careful to tell us that because of Peter's message, they also recognize that he's saying, Jesus did it. It's not me, it's Jesus. So they recognize the source of the healing is Jesus. And they put two and two together and they realize that if this man that walked in or that was carried in on a bed has now walked out, and if Peter claims it wasn't him, but that Jesus had healed them, then Jesus must be alive, that the stories that they're hearing, the rumors may be true, and that what Peter then says about Jesus and what he did on the cross must come with a weight of truth. Which, if you think about it, is just what the onlookers had to go through when Jesus healed the paralyzed man and preached and proclaimed forgiveness, only reversed the other way around. So in Acts 9, Peter follows Jesus and does the very works that Jesus did, proclaiming forgiveness and healing the sick. He does this under Jesus' authority, however. And that was predicted in John chapter 14. Jesus said, "Very truly I tell you, whoever believes in me will do the very works I've been doing, and they'll do even greater things than these, because I'm going to the Father." He's going to have authority in heaven. "And I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son." So Jesus was saying there that he would act in the world on behalf of those who would believe in him and his purpose, that God, his Father, be glorified. And this healing in the story becomes actually almost of secondary importance, because it's the gospel-confirming effect on others that actually becomes the focus. In them, healing triggers conviction of the truth of Jesus, and God is glorified. And of course, as we read this today, we have questions. I have questions. And it's probably worth just spending a couple of moments actually looking at what's going on here from the perspective of healing. Of course, Jesus' healings in the Gospels and the apostles' and disciples' healings in Acts are unmistakably supernatural. Nobody at the time, not even the enemies of Jesus, could undermine the fact that he did miracles. His miracles spoke loudly for themselves. The problem that people had was not with Jesus being a miracle worker, but that the spiritual claims that he said came with his miracles, his claims to being sent from God. But why did he perform miracles, and why do the apostles perform miracles? Well, in John 20, verse 30, it says that some of Jesus' miraculous signs were written down so that we might believe Jesus is the Son of God. So the purpose of some of these authors is to record enough of what Jesus did so we can go, he's completely different from anybody else that ever came before. We must listen to the message about him. But Jesus has words to say on why he healed. In Matthew 4, it's written, Jesus went through Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness among the people. So when he was about, the presence of miracle went hand in hand with the preaching of the gospel or the good news of the kingdom of God. And for the people at the time listening, there would have been things triggered in their head. They were familiar with prophets like Isaiah. They knew passages like Isaiah 35, Isaiah 42, Isaiah 53, which hinted, sometimes more than hinted, at a time of national freedom, teaching, healing and wholeness of person brought about by the Messiah's rule. And for them, the miracles of Jesus would align with these prophecies. And so they act as Jesus' confirmation of his authority, but they're like a little foretaste of his coming kingdom. Enough to make people listen and go, maybe it's coming, maybe it's beginning to come. So there's a significant group of people healed through the first five books of your New Testament. And of course, many will ask, does God still heal today? Or in what ways does he heal? It's a big topic. It's a close topic even for many of us in Bangor here. And of course, there is a diversity of opinions. Myself, I don't see any really solid scriptural evidence to show that God has decisively finished healing. Even, I think, I would be reluctant to restrain God and say he can't heal supernaturally today. But the miracles that God, or that we read about in Acts, appear to be sign miracles, primarily to demonstrate the presence and power of God. And I think these miracles were to supernaturally signify that this church of people, this new group, this distinct body separate from Judaism, was not just a spin-off, but was actually building on, growing out of Jesus and his ministry. These healings are definite supernatural reversions or recreations of damaged body parts, or even life itself. They're medically impossible. Paralyzed adults do not leap up on command. The blind do not see on command. The dead do not come back to life normally. But the miracles are also limited. Not everyone who was healed in who was ill in New Testament times was healed. Not all who died were raised to life. And though I and we might want to, I don't see the evidence that lets me extrapolate healings like these to suggest they were the norm back then or even today. But we don't want to limit this too much, because there is another category of healing. There's one that goes on all the time, and it's healing through treatment and circumstance, the operation that brings good outcomes, the medication that works, the medical condition that changes course over time, the wise input of doctors and nurses. See, if we teach a sovereign God who works all things together, who then is going to say that God is not involved in that way, responding in his gracious sovereign oversight to our prayer? I think that type of healing is in view in James 5. And the outcome there is perhaps not shock and awe for unbelievers. Instead, it's encouragement of the individual and the church. And I think we should give God credit for his graciousness to us when he lifts us up. And so I get a little bit uncomfortable when the two types of healing, if you hold that there are two types, are sort of lumped together into one. Because what can happen is that in front of a world that is watching and interested, is that we might call things supernatural or signs when the onlooking world goes, they just got better. they might just see normal medical recovery. So based on passages like this, I think that when the supernatural happens, and when God chooses to do it, it will be obvious to all. And the healings are his prerogative. Why was Stephen the martyr not raised to dead just after he died? I mean, surely that would have been quite a sign. There's a sovereign mystery here, and God's purposes can be veiled to us. But we're going to come back into the passage, and we've looked at Peter doing the works of Jesus. Now let's go on to look at someone else who lived a similar way, who followed after Jesus, and that's Tabitha. We're going to move a wee bit quickly through her story at the start because Luke does as well. He sketches it out quickly. She lives in Joppa, about 20 miles from Lydda. He introduces her as a follower of Jesus. Joppa sort of corresponds to modern-day Jaffa, a region in Tel Aviv. I'm sure some people here have been there. I doubt it looked like that back then. A seaside town. Tabitha is known for her work among the poor, her continual work among the poor, and we'll see among the widows, among the destitute, among the weak of society. And during the time Peter is at Lydda, she dies following an illness. And news of Peter's presence has already spilled beyond Joppa to Sharon, and it must have come into Joppa, because Tabitha's fellow disciples send two men quickly to Joppa and ask that he come back. And Peter's no celebrity. He doesn't ask for his private jet or a limousine to carry him. He just goes with them. And at the time, it would have been Jewish custom to carry out something known as Shemira, the watching or the guarding of the body. Some at the time believed that for 3, 7, or perhaps even more days, the soul remained close to the dead body and departed slowly. And so the body would have been washed, would have been simply dressed in linen garments with spices and attended the whole time until interment, which usually took place quite quickly. I think the wording implies here that Tabitha died before the messengers were sent, but we know that whatever the circumstance, she was definitely dead by the time Peter gets here because she's already prepared for burial. She's gone through that ritual. And as we read in the passage earlier, Peter comes into a scene of mourning. And it's poignant because here are the poor people. Here are the people who have nothing in the world. They're widows. Many have no advocate or carer with their husband dead. Tabitha had been that to many of them. It's fitting that those she had once cared for, whose needs had been met, had come to reminisce, support each other, and watch over their friend and fellow disciple now that she's dead. They're all together, as folks often do at funerals. They're remembering what the person was like. Look what she made me. Isn't it wonderful? She was so kind. They were upset. The room was probably packed. It was probably quite noisy. Can you place yourself there and just try and imagine what that would be like? And I can't help but wonder, what on earth was their expectation when they called Peter? Were they looking for comfort from someone that had been with Jesus? Because up until that point, no apostle had raised anyone from the dead. But I just wonder, by leaving Tabitha unburied, is there a clue that they hold on to some hope of miracle? After all, Peter healed Aeneas, like Jesus did. Jesus healed Lazarus. Could Peter raise someone from the dead? We don't know, but when we come to verse 40, we see that Peter's there with them in the room of mourning. And he must listen for a while, he must mingle and talk, but then he does something really unusual. He sends everybody out. Now, it's unusual, but it's not completely unprecedented. Because back in the time of Elisha, he raises a widow's son to life, again in an upper room, and he sends everybody away to do so. In Luke 8, verse 41, Jesus raises Jairus, the synagogue ruler's daughter, to life. She's 12. Again, an upper room where her little body was laid. And he only allowed her, her parents, Peter, James, and John, to be present. But that's a few years ago. And Peter's master is now ascended into heaven, and Peter is left. And in that cool silence of that room, he's once more having to walk by faith. He's walking where Jesus has been before. And I wonder, do you or do I ever get a feeling like that, an awareness of Jesus has done this, now I follow? So in verse 40, if you look at it, Peter doesn't lift up holy hands to pray, like might be expected at this time. He gets down on his knees beside the bed. And he prays, and we don't know what he says. But then he turns and he speaks to Tabitha as if she wasn't down there in death, but as if she was just sleeping. And maybe he remembers his Lord gently speaking in Aramaic to a little girl's body a couple of years before, where Jesus said, "Talitha kumi," little girl, little maid, get up. And so, following his master's example, Peter speaks. And if he did it in Aramaic, I believe it's almost the same phrase, "Tabitha kumi," Tabitha, get up. Tabitha, arise. Tabitha, get up from lying down. And she does. In a complete denial of every rule of this universe, she comes to life. Her heart beats. A spark begins to light her eyes. A flush of color appears once again. The Lord that breathed life into Adam and that made this planet buzz with noise and color and life has turned back death and brought new life where it was once departed. This is supernatural healing. It's a sign of the presence of God breaking into the world, and it's a tiny, tiny, tiny foretaste of what Jesus Christ will one day do en masse to everyone that dies believing in him. Tabitha and Aeneas are relatively unknown. We just know what Luke tells us. But they give a glimpse of what Jesus has, of how Jesus has smashed the curse and the futility of sin. They're a glimmer of that. See that power that resides in the Godhead that will one day surge through this spoiled universe and bring about, yes, judgment, but ultimately a new heavens, a new earth. And doesn't this story that we read today, set in another seaside town a long time ago, just make you begin to long for that? Do you know Peter did? Because he saw what seemed to be the impossible, but I think even in his heart it wasn't enough. He writes years later in 2 Peter 3, "We are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth, the home of righteousness." Do you know it's easy to skip over Aeneas and Tabitha? They are perhaps unfortunate in being sandwiched in between Saul's conversion and Peter's radical shift to Gentile acceptance, topics that are big and heavy in church history terms. But I think this has something to teach us, something about the church in a time of peace, because we are also a church in a time of peace. We don't experience persecution here in Northern Ireland. I don't know if you noticed, but Tabitha in verse 36 is given two names by Luke. Her name Tabitha means gazelle, but Luke also gives that Greek translation of her name, which is Dorcas. See, I wondered, as Tabitha moved around Joppa, among the poor, among the widows, quietly dropping off clothes, meals, whatever she did in her ministry, as she followed Jesus, as he led her each day through prayer, obedience to his teaching, the prompting of his spirit, did Tabitha not just cross money divides, working among the widows? Did she also cross that cultural divide between Greek-speaking Hellenistic Jews and Hebraic Jews? That might explain why some people know her as Tabitha and some people know her as Dorcas. See, that division was big and heavy at the time. It nearly split the church in Jerusalem. And I think Luke is showing us that she might well have done this. Here in Joppa, I think Jews of both sides of the Jewish divide spoke fondly of the gazelle. Some just called her Dorcas. Some just called her Tabitha. But they meant the same person. And so, as Jesus' disciple, she fulfilled his command in John 13. He said, "I give you a new commandment, that you love one another. Just as I've loved you, you should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples. So when we become Jesus' disciples, we might just begin to get uncomfortable with cliques, divides, and boundaries. Our service might not be in the same field as Tabitha. I'm not about to make you a robe or a tunic anytime soon, and you'll be glad of that. But doesn't Jesus open doors of opportunity to each of us when we place our gifts and abilities before him and let him move us? Because in this passage, Tabitha and Peter did. They didn't let social class or culture or geography dictate where Jesus used them. And I think we just have to be willing and ask him, which is food for thought. I reckon that like Tabitha, if we do that, we'll become more like Jesus. And that Jesus' promise in John 10, verse 10 of life and life to the full will begin to unfold in us. So I find this passage not just to be about healing. As I look at it and our experience as Christians, I think it gives us clues as to how we, the church, live in a time of peace. I mean, we know that from Acts that when there's persecution, the church, it almost picked up its evangelistic pace. Open doors show that all the time, and other organizations and prayer letters and so on. But spend time living maybe more in the Western world where it's a time of peace and even comfort, and so often we and our churches lose our way. And I think there's just a couple of clues in here as to how this can be prevented. And if you forgive me, I'll share a personal story. Last summer, I had to test a wee bit of, just in my work, a bit of prototype medical equipment. And I spent a few hours with electrodes strapped to my chest under my shirt and going out for a walk with this little box strapped to my side. I was testing a portable vital signs monitor, and you've probably had something similar done at the doctor. They take your temperature, they take your blood pressure, they may measure your pulse. This is something similar. So on the screen, up at the top, is my electrical activity of my heart as I'm walking about. And there's my breathing rate down below, two of my vital signs. And they show that at least in July last year, I was alive. I can't help but think the church also has vital signs. Signs that show that we are alive and in good health as followers of Jesus. And two of them are present in this passage. It'd be interesting to think and hear what others there might be. The first, individual saints living out their faith in Jesus in circumstances Jesus has placed them, using gifts he gives them. Tabitha, look at the content of her practical gifts used for the glory of God. And look at how her neighbors respond. Even in her death, she's a witness as they meet and gather and say about what a woman she was. She became more like Jesus the more she walked with him. And then the second and final vital sign that I'm going to talk about, evangelism and encouragement. Church, in times of peace, what an opportunity. Like Peter, we can use these times to consolidate the reach of the gospel as we train and encourage one another. But I think we also need to get frustrated and hungry with the status quo of the boundaries of where the church has reached. We need to be able to push forwards in the gospel at these times and not just wait for persecution to spur us into it. We have a good news to share. Why keep it here? And with that, I close.